All right, so welcome to week three, a little bit late here with gastric motility, and we're going to start with some generalities about gastric motility. So the three main functions of the stomach from a motor standpoint are to receive and store food. That's number one. We'll talk about accommodation, receptive relaxation, adaptive relaxation, and some unique features of the fundus. Then it needs to mix and chemically and mechanically break down food into smaller pieces for absorption later on. And then it has to empty in a very regulated fashion. So it's kind of like the three little bears, not too fast, where it's not broken down enough for optimal digestion, but not too slow, where it's causing some symptoms you may be familiar with from patients who have gastroparesis. The stomach accepts very large amounts of food, and it's able to do so without increasing the intragastric pressure. So it can expand up to 10 to 15 times its empty state. This is what is referred to as accommodation. We'll talk more about that briefly. The anatomy of the stomach is such that there are three layers of smooth muscle. If you remember, the middle one is the one that is the most prominent, probably does a lot of the heavy lifting, or I guess in this case, grinding and movement of food. So the outer layer is the longitudinal layer. It's absent on the anterior and posterior surfaces of the stomach. The middle circular layer is the most prominent. It is only absent in the paraesophageal area. And then there's an inner oblique layer, which is actually just two bands of muscle that you can remember exist where the longitudinal muscle is absent. So two bands of muscle on the anterior and posterior surfaces. And the longitudinal and circular muscle layers increase in thickness as you get toward the duodenum. There are the typical GI innervations, and so there are intrinsic nerves in the myenteric plexus between the longitudinal and circular layers and the submucosal plexus, and then there are extrinsic nerves, the parasympathetic nerves coming from the vagus nerve or cranial nerve 10, and then the sympathetic fibers from the celiac plexus. And the pylorus is a thickening and circular muscle at the distal antrum. It serves as the gateway into the duodenum, and we'll talk about some specific functions of it as we get further into this discussion. There are a lot of nerves with the pylorus as well as the proximal duodenum that give feedback to what the stomach is doing. We'll talk about those as well, but there's much very rich innervation of the distal stomach and the actually proximal duodenum that mediate a lot of reflexes. And then anatomically, there is a tunnel that I had never heard of before that's called Magenstrasse. And this is a functional anatomic tunnel. So those words often aren't used together, but this is a tunnel along the lesser curve. So we typically think food enters into the stomach. The newest food to enter is typically in the upper portion of the stomach. And then over time, as the stomach churns, it tends to move more towards the body and the greater curve. Well, the freshest food is often up top, sometimes up to an hour, and it's thought that part of the reason for doing that is that it allows salivary amylase to work on it before it mixes with gastric acid, which inactivates salivary amylase. And we'll talk a bit more about this lag with food that just enters the stomach, specifically with solid foods that we sometimes often see on gastric emptying curves, and why that happens in addition to just allowing salivary amylase to work. But for liquids, they empty the stomach very quickly, often in under an hour. And there's a tunnel that is formed along the lesser curve that allows the liquid to kind of skate over the rest of the more solid food bolus and exit the pylorus much quicker. And this is seen in some newer imaging modalities with gastric emptying research on ultrasound and MRI studies that can really show you different size particles and exactly what that movement is doing. And there's a great article reference from Dr. Graham at the end when we give you some other reading resources. The last thing I want to do, which we'll reference throughout the rest of the talk and as well as the other upcoming motility sections on small intestine and large intestine motility, are the intrinsic pacemaker cells of the GI tract. And there's some uniqueness in the stomach in that the stomach has a more rich clustering of these interstitial cells of Cajal, its pacemaker cells, along the greater curve in between the fundus and the proximal body. And so these in the stomach, it's a little different everywhere in the GI tract as to what the intrinsic pacemaking rate is. But in the stomach, they produce waves, basically, or slow waves, as they're often called, three cycles per minute on average. And so the importance of that is that's happening constantly. Not all of the time does a slow wave, which is produced by this ebb and flow of positive cations in and out of the cells, not all the time do these slow waves actually reach a threshold potential, which causes an action potential, this rapid influx of positive or cations. But when that does happen, there are some other things that can influence the likelihood that a slow wave triggers an action potential. And then when that happens, can impact how strong that is, so the amplitude of the contraction. And so these slow waves, though, are just an intrinsic thing that's happening in the entire GI tract. And in the stomach, they're three cycles per minute. So these waves, as they depolarize and then repolarize, the depolarization reaches this threshold potential. And when the threshold is reached, there's a rapid influx of positive cations, in this case calcium, that triggers contraction. And so we're not going to get into all of the specifics of calcium and actin, myosin, phosphorylation, all of that, but just to remember this sort of three cycles per minute, because we use that occasionally to define abnormalities in gastric motility on electrogastrography, for instance. And so in the stomach, when these slow waves are occurring, when there's food in the stomach, it triggers gastrin, which is one of the things that can increase the likelihood of actually reaching threshold potential and contractions. And there's stretch of the stomach, which triggers this release of gastrin and causes these vagovagal reflexes with acetylcholine. All of these things can cause increase in likelihood of contractions and then the strength of the contractions. And so they start at these interstitial cells of Cajal in the greater curve between the fundus and the proximal body of the stomach. And then they initially go circumferentially and then migrate down distally toward the antrum and pylorus. And the interesting thing is that as these contractions move toward the antrum, they're spaced a bit closer together, and the contractions are much more forceful. So if you look at the fundus during peristalsis of the stomach, there's little indentations. As you get down to the antrum, some of these contractions can be so powerful that they actually occlude the lumen of the antrum. We'll talk about why that's helpful from a mixing standpoint. The last thing is, so these slow waves are present throughout the GI tract. Three cycles per minute, baseline in stomach, about nine in the ileum, 12 in the duodenum. The fundus actually is unique in that the fundus does not have slow waves. And the fundus actually has a different resting membrane potential than the rest of the stomach. It varies a little bit in different parts of the stomach, but the fundus is unique in that its resting membrane potential is actually at or near threshold potential. And so it's tonically contracted, and that is inhibited by incoming food through vagal reflexes. It is inhibited through stretch. So once there's actually food in the stomach, that further triggers, you know, additional reflexes. But that is one unique thing about the fundus, is that it's tonically contracted. It can accommodate food and expand under the stimulation of acetylcholine through the vagus nerve and some other mechanisms. And then as the stomach is emptying, there are some periods in which it contracts a bit more to basically move the food and things from that are sitting in the fundus, the newer food, as we talked about before, into sort of the lower parts of the stomach to get mixed up. So we're going to end there. We're going to go through basically the receiving of food quickly, some of the specifics about the peristaltic pump and this mixing of food, and not only what that's doing and what's getting mixed together for digestion, but also how that's actually happening. It's not just this big bag that's contracting in an uncoordinated fashion. The actually fluid motion in the stomach during this is critical to mixing of food. And then lastly, we'll talk about the emptying of the stomach. We'll wrap up with sections on some of the unique differences between the digestive phase of what's going on in the stomach, and then the interdigestive or the fasting phase. And then lastly, we'll just talk about some of the things that regulate gastric emptying. So, as the thunder continues in the background, we will continue. And so I'm going to start with sometimes referred to as the pressure pump, the ORAT, or the more proximal part of the stomach, which is the fundus and the proximal corpus. And so this is this flexible reservoir. There's less thick musculature here. This is the area, if you remember it, that the resting membrane potential is actually at or above the threshold, and so it's tonically contracted. But as soon as food hits those inferior pharyngeal constrictors and there's lower esophageal sphincter relaxation, there's actually the beginning of gastric fundic relaxation as well. And this is the idea of receptive relaxation, which is part of accommodation. So before we talk about how this happens, if you think about an Airbnb host, when you talk about someone being accommodating as a host, we think they were prepared for us in the first place. But then in addition to it also is important that they're able to adapt to meet our needs. And so within accommodation, there's sort of a couple different parts. One is we know the food is coming, it's on its way down, we've swallowed, it's working its way down the esophagus, and the lower esophageal sphincter opens, and the initial part of the fundic relaxation is actually receptive relaxation. The other component of it, though, is adaptive relaxation. And so maybe the stomach wasn't aware that you were going to eat the amount that you ate, but further stretch and food actually in the stomach additionally causes this inhibition of that tonic contractions of the fundus to allow for accommodation. Much of this is vagal reflex driven, to the point that the stomach can accommodate 1.5 liters of food. And we talked before, it expand to from its somewhat collapsed state to 10 to 15 times the volume at baseline. There's some other things besides just knowing the food is coming from initiating a swallow and food in the stomach that cause fundic relaxation. So antral distension, duodenal distension, duodenal acidification, intraluminal perfusion of the duodenum with either lipids or proteins, and colonic distension can also further relax the stomach. In addition to relaxing the stomach, many of these things also contract the pylorus and impact the increase the actual antral contractions to some extent to further mixing. If you think about this, if the duodenum picks up that it's very distended, there may be just too much coming out too fast. If the duodenum is receiving too much at a time of this acidic chyme to the point where it's having difficulty alkalinizing it with secretions, we'll talk about it in a moment, or if they're very, very large amounts of lipid and protein, different osmolalities, those are all signs that, hey, stomach's emptying too much too quickly and we need to slow it down. And so that often involves further fundic relaxation, contraction of the pyloric sphincter, and then increasing of this antral contraction to further mix the food for digestive purposes. And so there's a unique degree of specificity. And one of the examples that I want to give that I think really drives this home as to how complex this can be is from Schlesinger's, and that's that fatty acid lengths greater than 12 fatty acids or chains that are greater than 12 fatty acids trigger in the duodenum release of CCK. This decreases fundic tone, antral contractions, and increases pyloric tone, so that basically it's things sit there longer and have more time to digest. And this is part of the reason for what we mentioned before, this early postprandial lag phase of about 45 to 60 minutes for solids as accommodation and slow movement of some of these larger, more solid pieces of food toward the corpus and then antrum occur. They need time and they purposefully have time for mixing. And the goal is that we're not emptying the stomach until most things are broken down to 1 to 2 millimeters. Once that happens, this initial lag phase in the overall emptying, especially the solids of the stomach, becomes more linear later in gastric emptying. So again, even the number of fatty acids in a chain can actually impact what the stomach is doing, as that is a sign that things aren't quite as broken down as we'd like them to be. The fundus mentioned, so it's thinner walled muscle, weaker contractions, the pressure at baseline during interdigestive state or fasting is actually the same as the intra-abdominal pressure. Even though it's tonically contracted, there are periodically these low amplitude, minute-long contractions that basically contract the fundus, and all of that fresher food that's been sitting up top gets mixed into sort of the stream of food that's getting mixed lower down in the stomach. So we're going to break here and then we'll go on to the peristaltic pump and actually talk about the mixing and how that. So we'll pick up here with the peristaltic pump, which is the caudate or lower part of the stomach made up of the distal corpus or body and the pyloric antrum. And these really do a lot of mixing. The interesting thing about the way mixing happens is that, you know, these interstitial cells of Cajal between the proximal body of the stomach and the fundus, when reaching threshold and under certain other stimuli, such as stretch or gastrin from peptides that are actually touching the antral G cells, these cause contractions and they start and come out from this cluster of interstitial cells of Cajal concentrically. Remember, the fundus at baseline is tonically contracted, but under certain stimuli stretch, and gastrin, a variety of other things further relaxes. But these concentric peristaltic waves move from the body of the stomach, and where they cause relatively weak contractions, and move distally and get closer together and closer together. And the strength of the contractions increases as it moves towards the antrum. And this can actually be so much so that it causes collapse or complete occlusion of the antral lumen. And so while this is happening, there's this antral duodenal coordination where these strong antral contractions, if the pylorus is open and the duodenum are open, would push way too much undigested food matter into the duodenum before it's really ready to be broken down and digested. And so oftentimes the duodenum, especially the bulb and the proximal duodenum, the pylorus, contract as the antrum is pushing this initial peristaltic wave towards the pylorus. And so particles of that are 1 to 2 millimeters or less and fluid can often escape the pylorus, but the majority of that food sort of being propelled towards the pylorus is not an anterograde jet. And the anterograde jet, the little bit that spurts through the pylorus, is almost in a pulsatile flow-like manner. But the majority of it actually gets retropulsed back into the stomach, and that wave breaks up some of the solid components of food that are clustered together and works to mechanically help with digestion, and it increases the surface area for acid and pepsin to work. Once the food gets down towards the pylorus, though, the third portion, you know, we talked about sort of the upper portion of the stomach as this pressure pump that does accommodation and receives food, peristaltic pump and mixing that we just talked about. When you get down to the pylorus, there's a pyloric complex that's made up of the pyloric sphincter. When you look at it, it's not this perfect circle of muscle. It's a bit wider along the greater curve, and it forms at the proximal and distal ends of the sphincter. There are muscle loops. Those are further away from each other. So the proximal and distal loops are further away from each other on the greater curve and a bit closer together on the lesser curve. And this triangular shape, almost when it comes together, forms like teeth in a gear and works to mechanically further break up some pieces of food that have been, as the pylorus acted as a sieve to keep these larger pieces of food from getting out into the duodenum too quickly, also needs to do something with them. So some of them are retropulsed back into the stomach. Some of them are also broken up further by the pylorus and the sphincter musculature and complex. And then the stomach side has these, remember we talked about 3 cycles per minute as the slow wave rate in the stomach. On the duodenal side, it's 12 cycles per minute at max. But when you look at the duodenum, mostly has phasic contractions. They're rarely continuous. And oftentimes it's a single or small groups of contractions to move some food that's been, you know, in a pulsatile fashion, kind of squirted out into the duodenal bulb. Majority of the duodenal contractions are not peristaltic and are more segmenting in nature. And so given the to and fro nature of segmenting contractions, this can either help gastric emptying or can actually, as we talked about before, can be part of this antroduodenal coordination where it may contract and help with that retropulsive jet of gastric contents back into the body of the stomach. And then the pyloric sphincter is somewhat tonically contracted. And so it can be relaxed by inhibitory vagal fibers through vasointestinal peptide and nitric oxide. Can also be constricted by certain excitatory cholinergic fibers or sympathetic fibers, as well as by CCK, gastric inhibitory peptide, secretin. And there are other things that make the sphincter contract as well. So if you think about this, many of the things that caused fundic relaxation to increase, too much acid in the duodenum, high or low osmolality, CCK, and acidification, we already mentioned, but large amounts of proteins and peptides, things that are not as broken down as we'd like them to be, those can trigger pyloric contraction. Remember, we mentioned the fatty acid chains that are longer than 12 fatty acids in length are a trigger for CCK, whereas less than that are not. But CCK, one of the things it does, in addition to fundic relaxation, slowing down the peristalsis of the stomach, is to constrict the pyloric sphincter. All right, so we're going to move on in the second to last piece, just talking a little bit about the differences between what's happening in the digestive period versus the interdigestive or fasting period in the stomach. So the intragastric or fasting phase of the stomach is characterized by a few unique things. During this phase, there may still be some large food particles greater than 5 to 7 millimeters that ultimately get just forcefully dumped into the small bowel. But there's also this entity called the migrating motor complex, or MMC, and this is a cyclical motor activity that's very closely tied to several other biological rhythms. And so, as a very quick aside, there are actually terms for things that happen in the roughly 24-hour cycle circadian rhythm. There are things that happen in greater periods of time, infradian rhythm. And then there are things that happen in a less than 24, roughly 24-hour period of time called ultradian rhythms. And there are a variety of examples of this. But one of them are in the fasting state, these migrating motor complexes, which happen roughly every 90 to 120 minutes, so every hour and a half to 2 hours. They start in the distal antrum, many of them, but not all, and go all the way to the ileum. These about 50% start in the distal antrum, about 50% in the small bowel. And these, again, are to empty non-digestible fibrous foodstuffs from the stomach and through the GI tract, because more time isn't necessarily going to be helpful with these. So in the phases, and there are some texts that refer to 3 phases and some to 4. I'm going to refer to 4, but I'll tell you the 4th is really this finishing of the phase 3 and moving back towards another phase 1. So phase 1, the first 45 to 60 minutes of fasting, the slow waves of the stomach no longer are associated with muscle contractions, and there's this motor quiescence due to some tonic inhibitory mechanisms. And so basically, if you just remember, for about the first hour in the interdigestive or fasting phase, the stomach is just kind of quiet. Slow waves are always happening, but remember, not all slow waves are associated with contractions. In phase 2, after about the first 45 minutes to an hour, there's another 30 to 45 minute phase in which there are slow waves that are all of a sudden associated with phasic contractions, these irregular random contractions, but not necessarily in a most coordinated fashion. And then phase three is where things really get moving. The activity front happens, and this is where there are these high amplitude phasic contractions that last 5 to 15 minutes, and they start, many of them, in the distal antrum, they migrate distally all the way to the ileum and while this is happening, the pylorus and the duodenum are relaxed, they're wide open. And so these big antral contractions, unlike when we're trying to mix food and grind food up and mix it with acid and pepsin, and cause retropulsive jets to break things up. Now we don't want that. We want things to move forward. And so the pylorus and duodenum are relaxed, and these big sweeping peristaltic waves move things all the way to the terminal ileum. One of the hormones that is sometimes brought up in board questions, released in the receptors for in the proximal duodenum in largest numbers is motilin, which plays a role, especially in phase three of the migrating motor complexes. So we had this quiescent phase, then these sort of sporadic, uncoordinated contractions all of a sudden that some of the slow waves are associated with, and then we have these 5 to 15 minutes of very coordinated, strong, sweeping movements, contractions to clear out non-digestible food and fibrous foodstuffs. So phase four, for the texts that include a phase four, are just decreasing contractions and moving into phase one. So there's inhibition of contractile activity, and this is... this is sort of just, some books call this phase four. it's important to note that this is the resting interdigestive phase. This is happening every 90 to 120 minutes. There's nothing you can do volitionally to make this stop except for eating. It's one of the main things that you can do. So as soon as you start to eat and you start getting as vagovagal receptive relaxation, lower esophageal sphincter opens, vagal input actually, or vagal stimuli, immediately inhibit the gastric motor and neurohormonal activity associated with these MMCs. So you stop them once you're no longer in the interdigestive or fasting stage. Some things about regulation of gastric motility. So you can have up to greater than a liter of material. It has several hours to leave the stomach, but not everything empties at the same time. You like to empty things that are less than or equal to 1 to 2 millimeters, cubic millimeters. And so that takes time. It takes time from a grinding standpoint, it takes time for acid and pepsin to work on those things, those larger pieces of food, to get them to be that small. And so there's a lag time in the gastric emptying curve, about an hour, for those things to start happening. Liquids leave quickly, immediately. Tonicity can also affect how quickly something leaves the stomach, and so high lipid or acidic concentrations of food tend to empty a bit slower compared to isotonically or near isotonic solutions. So things that are very hypo or hypertonic, very acidic, high lipid concentrations tend to empty slower. Not going to go into a lot of depth, but the neural control of gastric motility is significant in that the autonomic nerves can regulate it really either way. So in general, though, we used to think that the parasympathetic nervous system was, you know, the excitatory rest and digest. Sympathetic was inhibitory. But it seems in the stomach that the sympathetic nervous system probably has more of a limited role, that the vagus nerve can be inhibitory or excitatory. And there are different types of motor circuits. I'm not going to go into the Goyal article references these, but basically can either be part of a gastric inhibitory vagal motor circuit or a gastric excitatory vagal motor circuit. And these differ a little bit in specifically what the postganglionic nerve neurotransmitters are composed of. And so just end after saying the excitatory ones have postganglionic nerve fibers that use acetylcholine, that are cholinergic in nature. And the other ones are the inhibitory vagal motor circuits. The postganglionic fibers are non-cholinergic, but they're not all using norepinephrine and epinephrine's classic sympathetic mediators. So a couple of other just quick notes on things that can affect gastric emptying. A few things in the stomach that we already talked about, just to reiterate. So volume, which causes stretch, which can accentuate the pyloric pump. Gastrin can accentuate the pyloric pump and the strength of the contractions we talked about. Again, volume is going to be through a vagovagal stimulus. Gastrin is going to be through other G-protein coupled mechanisms. Duodenal mechanisms or things that basically affect gastric emptying. So there are inhibitory enterogastric neural reflexes. We mentioned some of these. So food enters the duodenum. There are reflexes sent to the stomach to slow or stop if there's too much chyme in the duodenum. And this can be multiple different layers of signaling. So it can be through the enteric nervous system, through extrinsic nerves, as well as through vagal nerves to the brainstem. So multiple mechanisms basically in which what enters the duodenum, which is this richly innervated area, can influence the stomach to slow emptying. It can also be stimulated, these reflexes, to slow down emptying by irritation or distension of the duodenum, acidity, osmolality that's either higher or lower than normal, so anything that's not isotonic, and specific protein breakdown products. And then there are some hormones from the duodenum that inhibit this. So again, we mentioned a couple of times now that fats, especially longer chains, so 12 or more fatty acids, trigger CCK, and that causes inhibition of gastric motility and causes the pyloric sphincter to contract to basically give it more time to digest. We're going to end there. The last short segment, I'm just going to reference a few resources I'd recommend checking out if you'd like to learn more. And we'll move on to small intestine motility for the next session. So a couple resources I just want to highlight. So the Lange textbook for GI physiology is a nice section on this. The Schlesinger's and Fortran chapter on this has about 8 or 9 pages at the beginning on gastric motility. From an article standpoint, there's an review article that's open access from the journal Neurogastroenterology and Motility. It was released in 2019 in November. It was released in 2019. I'm looking at multiple different dates that it was accepted and revised. Anyways, the article, if you look up Advances in the Physiology of Gastric Emptying by Raj Goyal, from Harvard in Boston, Massachusetts. He's one of the experts in the world on this, and he wrote with two other people, Dr. Guo and Mashimo, this great article on the advances in our understanding of gastric emptying that was part of Sarna and Dodd's lecture at the motility meeting in from ANMS in 2018. And so this was sort of a bit more elaborate version of the talk he gave. And then lastly, there's an article called Imaging and Modeling of Digestion in the Stomach and the Duodenum that is written by Dr. Schultz. And this was in Neurogastroenterology and Motility in 2006. But this really talks about the use of ultrasound and MRI and some newer ways of using imaging and modeling to understand what's actually happening to different compositions of food during gastric motility to promote digestion, and thinking about all these different size particles and fats, carbohydrates, and proteins, and retropulsive jets, and the action of acid and pepsin, and how all these things are really being orchestrated in a much, I think, more elaborate manner than we typically think about them. So that's it. Please stay tuned for the next time. And as always, please go ahead and email any feedback to me at jmshapir, S-H-A-P-I-R, at bcm.edu. And be happy to integrate those things or address those in a further podcast. Take care.